What's up, everybody? This is Marvin here in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia.
What's up, y'all? This is Michael in Williamstown, Massachusetts.
This is Josh recording live from Wampanoag Land.
Yo, what's good? This is Jesse reporting to you from Oakland, California, and welcome to another installment of the Melanated Social Work Podcast. We're glad to have you back. A couple updates that we have. In May and June of 2021, myself and Marvin will be offering our ASWB clinical exam prep course again. So make sure that you tap in on the website or check in the link tree on our Instagram. The website's www.melanatedsocialwork.com to make sure to sign up for those sessions in May and June. If you're getting ready to take your clinical exam, please make sure to do that. And as always, donate to support our work. You can tap in with the Venmo or a Cash App through the website or through the Instagram. Help support us continuing to do this work, y'all. Today, we have a very special guest. Brittany has come through to the podcast. Brittany, can you go ahead and introduce yourself for the folks that may not be familiar with you or familiar with your work?
Yeah, what's up? My name is Brittany Williams. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, social work entrepreneur, mother of three, MC, adjunct professor, et cetera. But I've been in the field for about 8 years. I own a group private practice in City Heights, San Diego.
For sure. And usually we ask folks just like what your energy is, what you're feeling today, but you know, since you coming through with like the hip hop energy and the vibes and stuff. So what is a song right now that kind of represents just your energy today?
I would say Lost Ones by Lauryn Hill. Just like completely the past this whole year I've been on that, just because if anyone knows anything about that track, it's kind of like her track to Wyclef and leaving like a toxic relationship and setting, going solo. And so that's not my situation in regards to relationship, but it is in regards to my relationship with social work, coming out of community mental health and like finally finding my voice and kind of like saying like, no, I'm going to do it this way and breaking free from that. So like, I definitely from, you know, her first couple bars, you know, it's funny how money changes situation, miscommunication lead to complication, my emancipation don't fit your equation. I was on the humble, you were on every station. So it's like, I was silent for so long and I like, you know, I didn't have a voice and now I've broken out of that. And I'm vocal on things that I never had the courage to speak on, you know, maybe 2 years ago. So
that's dope. I was actually literally just listening to that song like 20 minutes ago. I've group therapy tomorrow and I was gonna introduce some of these youngins to some El Boogie, but I'm trying to figure out what songs, but Lost One's definitely one of them.
Yeah, that whole album is just, I mean, it's spoken to me at every stage of my life. So
for sure. What about y'all, my melanated social work brothers? What is a song for where y'all are at? How you feeling today?
I'm gonna go ahead and go with the Drake. What's next? I had a full day. I'm ready for the day to be complete. And I know the song is like really positive vibes about like accolades about what comes next. So I'm channeling that energy to y'all about, you know, more success on the horizon. And I'm also holding the duality of like, what else could possibly happen today? So yeah, that's my energy right now.
So
for me, I think it's Umi Says by Mos Def. That's just one of my just favorite songs just ever. And just the vibe is just like super chill. You know, ain't a perfect man trying to do the best that I can.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it right there.
Thank you, bro. You already know that's one of my favorite songs. I have it tatted on my arm. Like, that's how I always like assess people too, whether they understand what that means. You don't know how many times I've gotten the, does that say Simon Says? I'm like, no, bro. Why would I have that on my arm? Like, Josh, what about you, bro?
So I went to the therapy this week with my, you know, my therapist, and she was like, you need to work on your boundaries with work-life balance and people, and it is what it is. And I've been seeing these shirts. I don't know if I'm saying her last name correctly. Alicia Teta, or Tita. She's a DSW student. She has her own private practice. She has this shirt I saw today called Black and Boundary. And I'm learning to be Black and to provide boundaries. So with that being said, the song that resonates with my energy is Everybody Mad by OT Genesis. Because when you put your boundaries out there, people will get mad, but fuck it. It's whatever. They'll get over it.
Yeah.
For sure. Appreciate you sharing that, man. I don't know what song it would be. I'm going to just rock with the last song I listened to. So I was just listening to that Her joint, Fight For You, off the Judas and the Black Messiah album. If y'all haven't seen the video for that, it's fucking dope. So yeah, I appreciate her energy. You know what I mean? Representing for Cali. So yeah. Cool. So Brittany, I mean, we got to just...
Before we get into it, I know that there's just been a lot going on with the hate crimes against Asian American folks. And so I feel like we just need to name that. And if we could just like take a moment of silence. Thanks, y'all.
For sure. Appreciate that, Marvin. Mm-hmm. All right. So rather than wait till the end of the episode to ask you this, I figured we just want to know right off top. So who's in your top five, Brittany?
So look, I change this all the time. But the first one that never changes is Big L, only because, like on a wordsmith type of, tip, like he is masterful with rhyme schemes, compound rhyming, multisyllabic rhymes, metaphors, similes, and master of punchlines. So not necessarily like his content and his message was influential, but like his craft of emceeing and freestyling, I just feel like not many people can match him. So rest in peace. So that's my first one is always will always be Big L. Second one is L Boogie, Lauryn Hill.
Yes.
She was the first MC of my generation that modeled like the balance of you could be feminine, but like you could also rock with, you know, the males or like, you know, whoever's out there. It's like that balance. And that was really helpful for me because the way I expressed my gender growing up, I grew up with, I'm the only girl. I grew up with brothers, and then my brother's friends and my uncle and whatnot lived with us. So I grew up with like 6-7 dudes in the house. Like I played football, basketball, and so listened to hip hop. And so I wasn't, I always was feminine in my own way, but I love sneakers. And so like Lauryn Hill, like really modeled that balance for me. And also, you know, her content is just, for every single thing she puts out, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I use her music in sessions, especially her Unplugged album, especially like Processing Trauma. And then, so I have, okay, my third one would be Tupac because he demonstrated, he taught me that vulnerability wasn't weakness before Brene Brown. And
that part
for real though, like he, you know, towards the end, could he have been more productive with his anger? For sure. Mutulu says that, right? But essentially, like he taught me that you can be real and you could, you know, you could express yourself and that's not weakness. And so fourth one is Kendrick, because Kendrick's just a special artist for me. I started listening to him when he went by KDOT in LA.
Yeah.
And my husband is a huge fan of like Lil Wayne and No Limit Records. And I didn't really listen to that kind of hip hop. And so I listened to, like, you know, Visionaries, Freestyle Fellowship, Living Legends. So my husband, like, he didn't listen to that. So Kendrick was kind of the balance of, like, the underground and mainstream. He, like, had that perfect blend. So Kendrick's just special. And then the last one, I'm going to go with Freestyle Fellowship. If I have to pick one artist from Freestyle Fellowship, I'm going to go with Micah 9, because if we didn't have a Micah 9, we wouldn't have had a Bone Thugs.
For sure. Yo, Freestyle Fellowship is one of my partner's favorites too, probably in her top five as well.
Yeah.
What was your favorite Big L freestyle?
The 98 freestyle.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. That's a cold top five. You know, I've heard a lot of them. That's a pretty cold one. I'm feeling
it's different. It's, I mean, I don't know. I feel like, I now get more into, like, where I'm from, but yeah, like, I grew up, like, experiencing, my brothers listened to East Coast and West Coast hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was introduced to underground hip hop, like, sophomore year. So I got and my mom's, like, a big Lauryn Hill fan too. So I got a good blend of music growing up.
For sure. I don't know if y'all had time to think about this beforehand, but does anyone else want to offer up their top five? Do you got it? Like, just off the top of your head?
I do.
Okay, go for it.
Pac, Big, Jay-Z, Nas, Kendrick.
For sure.
Wait, so say that again. Pac, Big, Jay-Z, or Nas?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because I feel like all of those kind of build off of one another.
Yeah, you had, like, the two of the biggest, like, rap beefs in history.
Yeah.
No.
Josh, what about you?
Yeah. I'm going to say, of course, Hov. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say Chuck D.
Mm.
I'm going to say, it changes. I'm going to say Master Ace.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say Andre 3 Stacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say it's a toss up between Raekwon and Ghostface.
Mm.
For sure. Marvin, you could tell us, like, your top five neo soul or R&B singers if you want.
I'm, like, sitting here thinking, I'm like, shit.
The pressure.
Oh, actually, I do. So I have, like, I got hip hop artists now. All
okay,
right.
Okay.
Versatile. No.
You had to write them down.
I was looking for my pad actually, so I go for a rumor. So Jay-Z, Biggie, Mac Dre,
yes.
Kendrick, and I would say Lauryn Hill as well.
Bruh. I appreciate the Mac Dre. Like,
yeah.
He goes in and out of my top five all the time.
And I'm gonna say that's my top five today.
Right.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's rotational. You know what I mean? You got the starting five, but folks rotate in and out throughout the game. You know what I mean? So I think for me, it's definitely Lauryn Hill. Like, I feel like she doesn't get enough respect put on her name. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like not just is she the dopest female MC of all time, she's just one of the dopest MCs of all time. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Then got my West Coast with Kendrick. I really feel like in terms of contemporary rappers, like, he's really the one that's, like, pushing the artwork forward. Andre 3000's in there. MF Doom, RIP to Doom. And yeah. Yasiin Bey, formerly known as Mos Def. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's
a good one.
Yeah. Cool. So yeah, Brittany, tell us a little bit about where you're from and your upbringing. How, you know, where did you come up and how did you really first get pulled into hip hop?
Yeah, so I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley, which is, it's like I want to say more than 30 incorporated and unincorporated cities east of the city of Los Angeles. So it's huge. So my dad is from East LA and my mom is from Monterey Park, which isn't far from one of their, like, neighborhood cities almost. So most people that grow up in the San Gabriel Valley, their parents or their grandparents are from the city, but they moved inland because the homes were more affordable. Right. And so, that's why I ended up in San Gabriel Valley, because my parents ended up buying a home. We first lived in West Covina, then they moved us to Roland Heights. So, But the San Gabriel Valley is like one of the most ethnically diverse communities brought together in close proximity. So, you know, I grew up, I had, you know, we had Black friends, Mexican friends, Filipino friends, Mexican-American friends, because that's different, right? We had Samoan friends, and like really the main thing that brought us together was hip hop, sneakers, and sports. And so, yeah, I mean, it was, so where I grew up, you have cities in the San Gabriel Valley that are like 10 minutes from the city of LA to 30, 35 minutes from the city of LA. So like Sugar Free, he's from Pomona, that's the San Gabriel Valley, but it's on the cusp of San Bernardino. And then it's also on the cusp of Orange County as well. And so growing up, me and my friends, we would go to LA, downtown LA, but we would mostly go to downtown Pomona, or most of the hip hop shows in our area were in San Bernardino. So they were in that area. So, it was, you know, the San Gabriel Valley is primarily known to be a place where most Asian communities came to settle. And so I grew up, around, a lot of my friends were Korean, from Taiwan, right? So, I mean, shout out to all of those communities and those neighbors that I grew up with. Like, I definitely, I think it's important that we are in solidarity with them. And I know I can only speak for, you know, my people and my culture. I think it's problematic when we get into comparison of our struggles and our trauma. And I think it's important that we, really look at it holistically, because essentially keeping us divided is only upholding white supremacy. And so, yeah.
So two kind of questions, right? And well, a couple of things. How do you like Last Chance U? That's one part. What are your favorite LA teams, if you have any? And did you ever see this documentary on hip hop in Leimert Park in the 90s when everybody would just come through and it was like real like lyricist lounge type stuff? So
yeah,
Last Chance.
Good Life Cafe.
Okay, yeah. You're cool. You got it.
You know what? I just finished the Last Chance U series and that hit home. Because while I was at USC, I went to ELAC during the summers to save money to take classes there. So I know that campus. My uncle went there. My family, my grandma's home is not too far from that college. So that hit home. I thought that series was really important for people to see what it's like from a non-traditional student's perspective. So I also think, that it's important. Like, one of the things that really stood out to me is how that I forgot the last name of the player, but his first name was Joe.
Yeah. Joe Moore. Yeah. He's the dude from Maryland and he came up, he was at Penn State.
Yeah.
And he was getting mad and yeah. Okay.
So what really resonated with me is how, like, they didn't kick him off the team, but they just allowed him to like process through those emotions and allowed him a space regardless. And so my brother's a football coach, and we always talk about like his students that are struggling behaviorally and struggling through processing different emotions. Many of them come with a history of trauma, and how the school board is like, well, if they miss X amount of games, they can't play. And my brother and I talk about like, this is all they have. Like, this is hope for them. And what, you know, what does that do to a student? And so I think that for Joe, for him to have that sense of support and community and having one coach that just did not give up on him, I mean, think about it, that could have been life or death. So that's, that series hit home for me. My favorite teams, I'm a Laker fan for sure. My favorite player is Iverson though.
Yes. I love AI. Yeah, that crossed Tyron.
Yeah, that was my favorite play ever. So I am a Laker fan, but my favorite player is Iverson. But I am a fan of like the underdogs just in general. So
you're a Timberwolves fan too?
Yeah, I mean,
No. There's not too many Timberwolves fans outside of the state of Minnesota. It's where I'm from. I think we're last place in the conference, but you know, next year's our year. So
yes, I'm rooting for you.
I was going to give you a lot of shit for being a Laker fan because I'm from the Bay Area and we just automatically just hate you all because Kobe just would always just annihilate us. But you saved it with AI, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, I love Kobe. I mean, Kobe and Vanessa, like, just, you know, they meant a lot to that family, meant a lot to the city of LA. When he passed, I was in LA with family, and like you could feel like the grief, you know. And so I think that was the first time I saw my husband cry in a long time. But I think it was an important moment to see grown men, you know, process and be vulnerable and cry and whatnot. So I'm a Laker fan. I'm also a USC fan as well, just because I grew up a USC fan. But I don't know, I gotta be honest, I'm a little jaded about USC. I've been jaded about being a USC alum the past year since, you know, the whole, what's her name, Lori Loughlin thing came out.
Full House.
Yeah, Full House, homegirl. So, yeah.
For sure. So, USC, is that where you went for your MSW or?
I went there for my undergrad. So, I went to a community college in San Gabriel Valley and mm-hmm. I took classes. I was able to transfer and I got accepted to USC. I had my bachelor's in sociology. It was really just my dream school. I never thought that I could make it to that level of academia. But I will say, my first day on campus, I was angry. Mm. I was angry because I was like, dang, like USC talks about how they value alumni. And if your parents or your grandparents went there, then you're going to have a better chance of getting in. And I'm like, man, my dad was in the military. He had to go to the military. My grandfather was drafted in World War II. Like, I made it here, but I'm around people that don't look like me and that come from that are very traditional students, right? So coming from a community college, being a single mom wasn't a big deal. Being Mexican wasn't a big deal. But going to USC, like, I couldn't afford to kick it with some of these cats in my class, right? Yeah. I went to school with like famous people and I was like, I was angry because I felt like a fish out of water. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and then the whole just work hard and you'll have the same opportunities. That was just a slap in you know, everyone that went to USC, that was a slap in our face. Yeah. To know that that's a myth, you know, that's straight up myth. And so, but with that said, I did find, I found friends there that were from, you know, Oxnard, Santa Ana, Covina, that were also transfers. And we just kind of stuck together and we, you know, supported each other. But, you know, I'm proud to be a USC alum because now I've created opportunity for my kids and, yeah, and whatnot. But it's still, you know, I look at it very different now.
For sure. No, I appreciate you sharing that perspective. I think that resonates very deeply with me, being like a UC Berkeley alum. There's a very like love-hate relationship that I have with that, like being that it's only, you know, 15, 20 minutes from my hometown. And it felt like a different world that I was stepping into.
Yeah.
Same with me in San Diego State. Yeah. You hear San Diego, it is a beautiful city, but San Diego State is very white. When I was there anyway, I can speak to that. It was like 70-something% white. And it was one of those situations where if you saw a black person, you'd be like, hey, there's one. Like, just you get hella excited about it because there weren't too many.
So Marvin, I'm curious because like I went to USC, right? Which is in like kind of the hood. It's like in the heart of LA. I don't live far from state.
Yeah.
So, but I live like in between El Cajon and University, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not it's not, you know, on the north side of El Cajon, which is very, you know, affluent and whatnot. So like, what was it? What did you have the same experience of like being in a space that was like, you know, your college is not diverse, but you're in a diverse environment? Or was it not like that back then?
I lived on campus.
Hmm.
So like for what the first, just the first year. And then I moved in with I had some roommates and we would just live down the street. So we were still in the college area. We were always in the college area. And it wasn't until I had to find a barbershop that I was just like, shit, I got to find where the black people at. And that was a little bit down. Damn, I can't even tell you what street it was, but I remember it's just a big ass hill you had to go down. And that's where all the people of color and like there was like Mexican restaurants and like soul food. I'm like, OK, this is where the BIPOC folks are.
Yeah,
that's not far from where I'm at.
Bro, that's what like, I mean, granted, Berkeley is like a very affluent city. I mean, back then when I went to Berkeley, there was still like a pretty strong black community in like South Berkeley and West Berkeley. But now that's probably not the case. But I just remember that being the energy of people on campus. Like they talked about Oakland, like, oh shit, like don't get off on the wrong bus. Like you're gonna end up in Oakland. And mind you, like, these motherfuckers was talking about like Rockridge. Like, so like when like they're not talking about like they're not in the wherever in the east or in the west and shit. Like they're in like the very white neighborhoods in Oakland. Like,
right. Yeah, people would ask me too, like, oh, you're from Oakland? Have you seen anyone get shot? Because I guess that is just what everyone thinks is Oakland, if you go there, someone's gonna get shot.
I think of hieroglyphics.
Yes.
No, but that was really, I think that was hard to go to school with like really wealthy, famous people, even famous people, right? But like them not know like the culture around literally across the street from campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, different experience.
So what was it that made you decide to go to school for your MSW? What was it along the journey that led you there?
Yeah, it was hip hop. Mm-hmm. It was being in studio sessions, mind you. So I had a setup at my house. I had like Newmark turntables. I tried to DJ for a hot minute. My Filipino friend tried to teach me a couple scratches. Didn't work out at all. I was terrible. But I had like Pro Tools and whatnot. And my friends would just come over and we would just write rhymes about breakups and family issues. And also like boasting about our self-confidence because we didn't really have any. So we had to like speak to it, right? To feel it. Well, I was at USC. I was performing and I was working with different like, you know, producers in the LA underground scene. And we were talking about real stuff. And at that time I was like, there's something therapeutic to this and I don't know how to prove it. And so I know I got to go to grad school to figure this out. So when I was at USC, I worked under Professor Taj Frazier, who is a professor of school communication. He does such dope work, but I did independent research with him on the art scene in LA. So looking at, you know, the disparities between like graffiti art and like gallery art and how privilege plays a role in that. Mm-hmm. I knew I had to get a master's degree. So, that really, and then also to find out that, you know, Scott LaRock was a social worker as well, met KRS-One in a homeless shelter. So I was like, okay, social work is probably the best route versus like psychology or MFT route. So
mm-hmm. Boogie Down Productions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You got your MSW in Hawaii, didn't you?
I got my MSW in Hawaii. Yes. I got married, and my husband was stationed in Bahrain, and then actually you pronounce it Bahrain. My friend's from there, so she's always correcting me on how to pronounce it. But he was stationed there, and he was awaiting the next duty station. So he picked, I think it was San Diego. We wanted to stay in San Diego, but then it was Hawaii, Japan, and then like Missouri was our last pick. So we got no diss to Missouri, but so we got Hawaii. So I applied there and I got in. So I just wanted to take advantage of, mind you, I was a single mom for 6 years and I'm getting married. So I'm like, I want to take advantage of the time to continue to, and now that I have support, right, and we're a team, I want to continue my education and also, like, you know, what I'm passionate about too, which was hip hop.
Yeah. So it sounds like you went into getting your MSW with like a very clear picture of like building out this hip hop practice and wanting to like bring that into like healing spaces.
I was very intentional about that. You talk to people I went to grad school with, I was trying to figure it out. Like, how can I merge these two worlds? Because if you know about like the history of hip hop, true hip hop, cultural hip hop, not corporate, cultural hip hop, there are inherently healing practices within the culture. Yeah. And so I wanted to figure it out. And so I was intentional about that.
That's what's up. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on like what qualifies someone as like a hip hop therapist? Just because I think especially for folks of color in the field, like we often question our own expertise, or there's this perpetual like imposter syndrome. And so like, I don't know. And we operate in a field that's so just like built on norms of like white supremacy. So like, if you're not certified in something or you don't have this training or whatever, then like you can't put that in your bio. You know what I mean?
I love this conversation because this is exactly why the pioneer of hip hop therapy, Dr. Edgar Tyson, didn't trademark the term hip hop therapy. And so I think and people are trying to do that. And so I think it really comes down to what qualifies someone to call themselves hip hop first. Mm-hmm. So for me, what qualifies you to be hip hop for me, and everybody has a different way of thinking about this, is paying homage to the people that did the work, right? So whether you want to say it's Muhammad Ali or KRS or, you know, whoever it is, paying homage is for me key. If you're not paying homage to the people that did the ground, the work, then you're not hip hop to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to sit here and be like, you know, I'm the greatest, you know, female MC and not give props to Medusa and not give props to Lauryn Hill and MC Lyte, who was the first female artist to put out an album. Like, they had to do that work, and I have privilege because of that. So I think one, it's paying homage. And then I think another thing too is partaking in the elements of hip hop, because you see hip hop being used in hip hop education, you see hip hop being used in TikTok, and I'm gonna be honest, like, there was this one like really notable TikTok creator that created a TikTok rap, and I was like angry. I was like heated about it. I'm like, why am I mad? And it's because, like, you don't know about like the female experience in hip hop, one, and then you don't know about, like, you don't know that hip hop is a culture. It's not a genre. It's not a musical category.
Yeah.
So I think that partaking in the elements of hip hop. So what are the elements of hip hop? It's DJing, it's, you know, emceeing, It's breakdancing, it's graffiti, it's street knowledge, it's being a street entrepreneurialism, it's street language, right? Like, it's knowledge of self. And I think that that's where therapy comes in, because you have to have knowledge of self, because knowledge of self is I'm going to speak on this issue, but I'm going to stick with my principles. And the hip hop principles is peace, love, unity, having a good time. Mm-hmm. You have many artists that aren't sticking to those principles. And that's where we get into, you know, they're not, to me, like, there are some artists I would say are not hip hop because
they're not true
to those principles.
Yeah.
And so, I would start there. Can you even call yourself hip hop? Right. And then I also think that there are parallels between that and social work or being a therapist,
mm-hmm.
because you have many, it's the same thing. Like, you have many therapists getting into this work because they want the fancy acronyms after their name, or because they want to be called a professor, or because they want to be called a psychotherapist, but they're really not for the people.
Free.
And so those to me are not true therapists or social workers. And yeah. So I think a lot of it comes down to sticking with your principles, which I don't think grad schools talk enough about this. Mm-hmm. The NASW has these principles, which is cool, right? I'm glad that they came up with those, but here's the thing. What are they doing to help us uphold those principles?
Yeah, there's something about social workers don't typically hold other social workers accountable, at least in a similar way that, like, if you're claiming hip hop, you know, people are going to, you know, check and know if you actually know what you're talking about. You know, I even think, like, Josh asked about, like, the documentary earlier. You're like, oh, yeah, yeah. And he's, oh, yeah, of course. Okay. Yeah, you cool. Like, there's something about, I don't know, accountability in hip hop that's not, social workers just don't do it.
Right.
So bringing up some dope stuff, and we brought it up with when we interviewed the Joy of Social Work, or Joy, who's my cousin actually.
What?
Yeah.
That's so dope.
You know, so
runs in the family.
You know, so I even made a little rhyme for Joy. Jealous ones imitate. For Josh, jealous ones still hate. You know, but at the end of the day, we just try to be great and melanate and elevate. Feel me? So that's how I feel about it. But what I was going to say was you brought up producing and recording. Who are your top five producers, recorders, beat makers? I'm going to judge. I'm going to judge you too right now. So I'm letting you know.
He said, I'm going to judge you, bro.
All right.
It's a safe space, Josh.
Dang. I've never been asked this question, so I'm just going to throw it out there. I mean, I would definitely go with J Dilla, but Rematic,
mm-hmm.
Babu, Hubert. Mm-hmm. I do like Soundwave a lot.
Sure. Yeah. I like it.
It's probably super underground, but.
You got a top five, Josh?
Absolutely. Dilla, of course, right? I'm going to say RZA. And speaking of knowledge of self, I had a, like I said, with Joy as well, I had a breakthrough with a young man using the 12 jewels from the 5% Nation to learn about himself.
Mm-hmm.
On one of Raekwon and Ghostface songs, it's called Black Jesus, right? And I remember going to South Africa and, like, reciting it because it talked about the original man, right? And I let that young man know that as well. So knowledge of self. So Dilla, RZA, Knife Wonder.
Oh,
dang, I forgot about that.
Pete Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Premier.
For sure.
Yeah.
See, the producer one is harder for me because I'm more drawn to the beat. So, like, my list of producers, like, that's much harder to cut down to the top five than the MCs are. But Dilla's definitely in there. Madlib's in there. Shout out to Oxnard. New Jobbies is in there. MF Doom, he makes both categories, top five MC, top five producer. And then to show some love for the Bay, I gotta go with A+. Like, you can't fuck with the Souls beats. Like that first album was just perfect.
I think he follows us or other people from Hyro. So.
He does. A Plus does follow us. He follows me on Clubhouse too. Shout out to A Plus.
Shout out to Hyro, you know. Hyro. Shout out to when we went to Hyro Day that time too, Jesse. You know what I mean? Yeah. We saw, let me not say that rapper. He's controversial. We saw Mr. Fab. Who else we saw? We saw MERS.
Yep.
We saw Just Blaze.
Mm-hmm.
Who else did we see?
It was a good day. Marshawn Lynch just walking around chilling.
We saw somebody from Tony.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good day. So I'm curious, like, for you coming into this work and bringing hip hop in, I'm wondering, like, what has that been like for you being a woman of color in this space? I mean, because you spoke to a little bit earlier just around the experience of what it was like for female MCs to come up and some of the adversities that they face, like being a part of this work and being a part of the hip hop community. What was that mm-hmm. like for you?
So I went to grad school and I'm like, I'm going to figure out how to do this. And I was introduced to Beats, Rhymes, and Life by a professor. Mm-hmm. And then I did research and I found Dr. Edgar Tyson was the one that started doing this work like years before anybody, right?
At Fordham, right?
At Fordham, yeah. So I'm like, yo, like, so Tyson's work basically gave me permission to be myself in social work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had these big dreams and then I reached out to JC Hall, which was Tyson's mentee. And then him and I had been in communication for several years. But then my husband got out the military. We moved back to San Diego and I'm looking for a job. And, you know, I went right into agency-based social work where they're like, oh yeah, that's a cool idea, but you know, be careful because this and that. And so I hit a lot of walls in that setting just because there was fear. And then there was just a lack of understanding of what hip hop was because of the rep it gets, right? Mm-hmm. From a mainstream corporate level, hip hop is known to be violent and sexist and whatnot. So that I hit a huge wall within social work, but my personal experience within hip hop culture in general, again, like I think one of the things that's important to know about me is I was more so personally immersed in underground hip hop, cultural hip hop and culture. So KRS distinguishes the difference that corporate hip hop is about the eye, right? Corporate hip hop generates rappers and rappers basically amplify the eye, like I'm the greatest MC to ever do it type of thing. Or, you know, these are my struggles. This is what I, you know, so what I'm going through, or what this is, you know, what I want or what I'm experiencing. Whereas cultural hip hop generates MCs that are about the we. Mm-hmm. And so some of our favorite MCs, like Umi says, those artists already tell you how you feel because they've already taken inventory of your experiences. They're observing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was around a lot of cultural MCs that were about the culture, that were upholding principles, that, you know, weren't going to sell their souls or spirits out because they wanted to make money, because a lot of us weren't in it for money. We were just doing it to express ourselves because it was a cathartic release. So a lot of my friends, most were males, producers and other MCs that guided me into that work in the LA underground hip hop scene, were just like, be dope. You're not a female MC, you're an MC. And so I was like, okay, like I'm just gonna focus on being dope. But then with that, it generated the, like, when people would be like, hey, let's do, can you feature on this song? It was like, well, that imposter syndrome came in where I'm like, do you want me to feature on it because I'm a female and you want that perspective or that sound, or do you want to feature because I'm dope? And so then you get into, you know, I there was certain people that were like, hey, like, you got to be a little rough and rugged with it, like curse on your songs, or like, you know, market the fact that you are a female and dress, you know, to that. And I'm like, I'm not interested in that. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not interested in, you know, making money or profiting off of this. I just believe in the movement, because mm-hmm. so many of us came out of the Good Life Cafe, which was what Josh was talking about. And so we were influenced by those MCs, the Micah Nines, Tumex, like the artists that, and they weren't gangsters. They were dope artists mm-hmm. that mastered the craft of MCing and whatnot. So there was sometimes this tension of from other females that it was like, there's only one place for us, and it's either you or I type of mm-hmm. thing. But that was perpetuated by males, right? Because, and that's perpetuated by the culture too, because when we look at all female rappers, we even get into the corporate side. Lil Kim came out of Junior Mafia. Lauryn Hill came out of the Fugees. Mm-hmm. Eve came out of Rough Riders.
Yep.
Charlie Baltimore came out of Ja Rule's label.
Murder Inc.
Yeah.
And then, it's the Boo came out of 3 Sick Mafia.
Yeah. And so it's like every female came out of a male dominated crew, and there was just one of them. There wasn't mm-hmm. room for two or three of them. Mm-mm. And so that being modeled for us, like we could, there was some instances where that was brought into that scene, but going to hip hop shows in LA, like Medusa was, shout out to Medusa. It's her birthday today. But Medusa was like honored, and like she was the one to end the show. She wasn't opening up for people, and I'm younger, right? So she probably experienced that herself coming up in the game. But like when I went to go see hip hop shows, like she was upheld as like the queen of the LA underground scene and whatnot. She calls herself Medusa, the gangster goddess. And so there was definitely the struggle again, as I'm reflecting on my experiences, is there was the struggle of being the fish out of water and believing in myself, the fish out of water at USC, the fish out of the water in hip hop, right? The fish out of the water in Hawaii, like struggling to fit into military culture, which was a struggle. I didn't connect with many of the military spouses just because we were in different life stages. Mm-hmm. Like I was a lot older. And so yeah.
For sure. Just hearing about the experience of like being a woman in hip hop, I'm curious if there are folks now that are coming up now that like have really caught your ear that you think are like carrying that torch of like Medusa or like El Boog or Ladybug Mecca, like who are you listening to like right now that's on the come up that you're like, yes, they're that shit?
Snow the Product.
Mm-hmm.
Snow the Product, just because like being a Mexican chick, like, you know, she definitely is, I relate a lot to her just mm-hmm. in her style, but she has bars. Like she's a bar spitter. Mm-hmm. Rhapsody, of course. Mm-hmm. I gotta be honest, like I don't really listen to like Cardi or Meg the Stallion. I actually heard her on I think it was like a freestyle. She could spit though. Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of Tierra Whack from Philly?
I think so.
Tierra Whack is cold.
She's dope.
I think I was just put on to her. She's on Instagram, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she is. Her whole aesthetic is just hella wild. It's shit. Like, yeah. I love it.
She's like, some of the videos remind me of old Missy videos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's dope.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll check her out. I definitely am mindful of my mental diet though. So I'm about listening to music that makes me think or has like a meaningful message. Nice. And so, I really haven't like researched anyone. And so They're probably out there. I don't know. I haven't done any looking though.
Yeah. Lil Sims is nice too.
Okay.
She's fresh. And she's like a fucking amazing actress too. Like, I didn't even know she had acting chops like that, but she held it down in Top Boy.
Oh yeah. Mm.
For sure. I'm curious, like, what advice do you have? Because I'm in community with a lot of folks that are just like hip hop heads and also clinicians and therapists. I'm curious, like, for folks that are in that process of having a difficult time of understanding, like, how to marry these two parts of their identity and just like sit in and just like bring that into their practice. Like, what advice do you have for clinicians listening that are seeking to do that?
To bring in hip hop or to just bring in themselves?
Like, I guess it's that, you know what I mean? That, like, I don't know, to let go of that imposter syndrome, to acknowledge that this part of their identity that they've grown up on and is like very much a part of them, that belongs in that space. And is there like a right way to do that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I just had a MSW inbox DM me today thanking me for, she's like, I found you on TikTok and I just want to thank you because you're the first social worker that I see myself in.
And your TikTok game is strong too. I don't, the shit looks intimidating, just, but you make it look real seamless and everything. So I just want to shout that out.
But, I'm learning that is a new marketing route for, you know, for business. So my partner Carlos, he's like totally against social media, so I've had to really work him into like understanding what the difference is, because TikTok, you actually have to, like, you have to create content, like you can't just post something, right? So you really get to see people's personalities and whatnot. But yeah, so I think that, I know for me, I really resonate with what you're saying, Jesse, because I experience the same thing of not feeling like I fit into this work and not feeling like I'm capable and qualified to take risks and to challenge things. And it wasn't until I found you and Joy where I started to do that. So representation matters, because even though you're not, you know, a Chicana from SGV like me, I was like, oh, social work doesn't have to look like this formal thing. And so, you know, I remember I watched Joy do Instagram Live with my, he's like my cousin with Aaron, who's a therapist out here. And she shared her experience of like stepping into opening up her practice. And I reached out to her like this time last year. And I was like, thank you for sharing your story, because I'm in the same boat and I'm scared. And she's like, I was scared too. And like, so I think it's important for us to be authentically, unapologetically us. And so when we're looking at imposter syndrome, we're first of all, we're minimizing our accomplishments. We are living in a constant state of fear that people are going to find out that we don't know as much as we say we do. We are constantly second guessing ourselves. And so what you're essentially dealing with is a core belief issue. The core belief of I'm not enough, or I'm not worthy, or I'm not smart enough. So the first thing you want to do is you want to interrogate where that came from. Where did that come from? Because we know as therapists that that comes from either childhood, you know, whether that's elementary school, middle school, high school, young adulthood, something happened mm-hmm. that gave us that message.
Yeah.
And we have to do the work. That's why we have to go to our own therapy and really process through this stuff so that we can interrogate where that came from and then challenge the evidence that we currently have to support that core belief.
So always ask my clients, whose voice is that? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whose voice is that? Yeah.
It's you brought up some dope points about, there is a young lady, FPXB, her name is Claudia, and she posted something recently about just like people or social work admissions need to look at the people who are coming in or they're admitting, because a lot of people, like you were saying, they just wanted to have the nice, fancy, checked off credentials, but they're really not about, you know, empowering people that are like marginalized by these systems, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important. And then if you haven't watched it yet, there's this documentary of Ninth Wonder called the Harvard Hip Hop Fellow or the Hip Hop Fellow. And he does a hip hop residency at Harvard. It's mad dope. And I remember being in grad school and watching it. And I learned that Wu-Tang Clan Ain't Nothing to Fuck With was sampled from Underdog, right? So then I was at my final year placement and I was and I was humming it and the kids like, oh, what's that? It stopped. And it was a bunch of kids around me. And they're like, yo, can you teach us that? And it was like, wow, that's a grounding tool, just humming. I had never seen anything. And I was like, I think I got something right here, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like from, you know, from the grounding, from the affirmations that I've used, like I get out of all your boxes. You can't hold me in these chains. I get out of all your boxes. Like I've had clients meditate on that. One of the things that I do with hip hop therapy is I play Umi Says, and then I'll have them pick what part of the song they're gonna focus on and meditate on. Is it the bass line, or is it the keys? Is it the voice? Is it the cymbals? So there are so many, because if you think about it, that's what producers do, is they focus their time on one piece of the art, whatever that is. And so the other thing that is inherently therapeutic about hip hop is breath work. So as an MC, you have to master timed breathing. And that is, you know, a big part of mindfulness and whatnot. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. You spoke to just like opening up your private practice and just how, you know, Joy was an influence and a teacher in that moment. Shout out to Joy from Joy of Social Work. And just generally like the different ways in which you're engaging in this entrepreneurship through TikTok or through other formats and things like that. Can you speak a little bit to like who else were some of your teachers? Like, where did you soak up game on that? And why don't you think there's more information that's provided to us in like social work school?
Yeah. My partner Carlos opened up a coffee shop in City Heights. And it the core elements was, I think it was community, coffee, community, and culture. So he infused social work into a coffee shop space, and it was outdoors. And he was throwing like these events. We had like a suicide awareness event. People came up, did spoken word and whatnot. And I met him by just grabbing a coffee. Mm-hmm. And so I had started to connect with him. Then I met other like-minded social workers, and I was like, yo, okay, not everyone is like this. And so he was like, here's the real, I'm gonna get transparent. Last year, I had my son, and I was just like, I'm just trying to get this money. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just trying to get this money.
Yes.
And so I interviewed with PERT, which is Psychiatric Emergency Response Team. They're licensed clinicians that work with cops, in January of last year. And I remember going in there, I'm like, I don't really want this, but I'm trying to get this money. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get it, which is great. I'm glad I don't think I'd be able to last. But I had coffee with Carlos, my business partner and homie, the day after. And he's like, you don't really want to do that. Like, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, like by the time Troy is in kindergarten, I want to teach more and go private practice full time. Mm-hmm. He's like, let's do it. And I'm like, it's a little bit difficult. Like, you know, I'm going back into that imposter syndrome and like not feeling like I'm prepared enough to do this. He's like, dog, let's put our money together. Let's do it. And I'm like, okay. He's like, let's create a Google Doc. We'll create a checklist. Tell me everything that you know based off of your knowledge. Reach out to your friends who are in private practice, which I only had one. and let's get it done. So Carlos had already had like opened up businesses. It just was in private practice. And so we created that Google Doc and we just started like knocking stuff out, right? We started figuring out like, can we be an S Corp or an LLC in San Diego? So in San Diego, we have to be an S Corp, right? And we're a group practice. So it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But the other thing too is our mentor, who is an older white lady, basically was like, look, start your private practice. You could take clients and see them under my practice. And I'll only take 15%. 15%. That is like unheard of. Typically, the percentage is 30%, 30-70% split. But she used her privilege, right, to give us a starting point. And then from there, we just built and we've had clients hit it. We've had, I'm trying to stop saying the word clients because that really needs to change. We've had folks hit up and they're like, hey, you're the only non-white therapist in our neighborhood. And that's why I called you.
The show.
And so it really started with just pulling from what we had. And then also people that had privilege and years in the game give us that starting point to push forward. Now, why don't grad schools teach us about this? It's because they prepare us to go into work for other people and not ourselves. And for me, I don't know if that's intentional, but it definitely feels like it. Because if you think about it, we're rewarded for it. Mm-hmm. You have the Title IV-E programs where you get to go to grad school for free, but you got to work 2 years of the county.
Yeah.
You can get loan forgiveness if you work 10 years at a nonprofit.
Yeah.
Like, why is that? Like, we're doing the same work in other settings, but we're rewarded to kind of stick in this model and to fund people that that are servicing the communities that we're from. Mm-hmm. And so I know has a responsibility that I take on is I teach my students. I teach social work fields of service. I teach them social work entrepreneurship. I teach mm-hmm. them social work entrepreneur mindset, which I pull a lot from Damon Dash, which I used to think was just a really angry dude, but I totally understand him now. I totally get it. But I pull from Damon, Dame Dash, I pull from Master P's mindset, right? Okay. I mean, it's going to take people like myself, like Joy, and other people that are taking these risks and figuring out on their own to teach other social workers how to do this.
Yeah, I mean, when you said like, oh, I was trying to get this money, like it's almost treated like in social work that's like blasphemous if like we are of that mindset. And it's like, yo, like we deserve to not struggle for our entire lives. Like we have had enough. Our ancestors have had enough. They struggled so that hopefully we didn't have to struggle. And like these things should be in line. We should be able to be social workers, to live by a set of values, to do good work. And not struggle. Like we deserve to get the bag. Like,
why aren't, I don't know. Like I always pose this question of should social workers be unionized, right? Should we, should there be a cap on how many cases these agencies are giving us? Should we be protected when we are asked to do something outside of our principles and ethics? Because you look at certain cases that have gone wrong and you're supposed to uphold, you're held accountable by your code of ethics, mm-hmm. but people also got to eat, right? So like mm-hmm. you're choosing between being client-centered, but mm-hmm. then paying your bills. And, you know, regardless, I'm going to stick with my principles, but that comes at a cost that a lot of people can't take.
Yeah.
Another dope social worker also from San Diego, Kim Young, shouts out to her. She had a post recently. Oh, you know?
Kim Young?
Yeah.
Dope Black social worker?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, a huge fan, yeah.
From like San Diego or just the Grin?
No, I don't know her from San Diego. I know her just from, I actually learned about her when she was featured on your podcast.
Oh, cool. He has a quote that's like, I do not allow my brain to be picked, because a lot of people think that the free game, that our licenses and degrees, like you can't do that other places like that. And people just, they think they can just slide into DMs and do this, do that. And there's a line with that at times, but like overall, bro, I don't know you. Why are you getting in the DMs? You know how much debt I have because of this degree? And it's like nah, bro. And I know another, kind of shifting gears, another story. I think you hit us up and you told us one time you were with your son in a park and you saw somebody who wore some of our gear. Can you tell us about that story?
Yeah. So it's funny because it's not funny. It's just the way the universe works. But I had saw her posted on your Melania Social Work Instagram, and I was at the park with my son and my husband, and I'm like, yo, I think I know her from your Instagram. And so I was like, hey, are you a social worker? She's like, yeah, I'm a social worker. I'm in my last semester. I'm like, oh, dope. Like, hit me up. Like, when you're done, like, I'd love to do work with you and you need anything. And she's like, we're still figuring out scheduling to link up. But yeah, that's what happened. You brought us together.
Oh, wow, man. Melanie is social work, bringing people together. Yeah. That's a plug too. Don't forget to support the merchandise, y'all. Hit the website and support the merchandise, because Melanated Social Work, we are trying to get this bag. We really trying to get this paper shamelessly. And we trying to do it doing something we love. You know what I mean? So support the work.
And the gear is fresh. Like, I wear that sweater. I wear my sweater to session all the time. The other thing that I think we need to talk about, maybe this is a whole other conversation, is like, you know, social work in regards to dress does not have to be formal. You know, I know for a lot of the folks that I support in session, like, it's, they have shared with me that they're grateful that it's not this, like, you know, suit and like I'm taking notes. It's just like, I look like a regular person, because a lot of the people that I'm working with, there's a stigma about therapy to begin with. And so, you know, if you like to dress, that's cool. But I also think that it doesn't have to be that way. And I think that agencies and corporations and departments really need to start thinking about that.
Yeah. It's like, you should just dress who you are. Like, be yourself. Like, if you ain't gonna go walk around your neighborhood in that shit, like, don't wear that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, be yourself. Like, represent who you are. Because, I mean, yeah, and like connecting it back to hip hop, right? Like, dress has been like a mode of communication, like, and that's entirely a piece of the culture. And so yeah, what we wear, it makes a political statement. So
it's art. It's art.
And speaking of things we wear, right? Like, at my former job, I used to love rocking, just like, I'll work at a hospital during the week, and then on the weekends I work at a clinic, and I was allowed to just be Josh more, and I would wear my Stan Smiths.
So tell us about like what you're doing right now as a professor and the teaching. Like, how long have you been doing that, and what's the focus that you're working on right now?
So I've been teaching since 2018. I teach Intro to Social Work and Social Work Fields of Service. So Intro to Social Work's like history, theory, interventions. And then Social Work Fields of Service is like actual jobs that social workers do in the field. So from like child welfare social work to research to medical hospital social work, et cetera. I've definitely evolved as an educator. When I first started teaching, I was like firm on deadlines. I'm like, look, you got to get it in, because I have a grading period. And in social work, deadlines are everything. And if you don't meet the deadline, you don't get paid. So I was always flexible with certain situations, but I was much more firm in that sense. And I think one of the things that I had to learn and be humble about is like, just because I was a single mom and I went through school and I was able to get through does not make my experience anywhere similar to theirs. And so, right now I'm just really focusing on really supporting my students to like know what social work is about and do their work. And I always ask my students, how comfortable are you not being liked? How comfortable are you? How comfortable are you to challenge people? Because you need to get comfortable. Nobody taught me that. So like, I'm basically teaching them everything that wasn't taught to me. And then I also have people come in and talk to them that are in the field and give them a wide scope of what they can do. Because I know for a lot of people that don't know about social work, they first think about child welfare. Mm-hmm. And so to introduce them to like a vast, you know, amount of work is really my main focus, is just to give them a realistic idea of what it's like to be a social worker.
For sure. When we gonna get the melanated social work guest lecture popping off?
I would love to actually have you all like come and speak like to the whole college. So I'll work on that. I don't know when we're all gonna go back though. So, but yeah.
We're down to talk some isms and talk about how to not compromise who you are while doing this work.
And that's the type of stuff that we didn't really, we've heard the lips, put it like this. You know how somebody smiles at you? Their mouth smiles, but their eyes aren't smiling. You can feel the soul doesn't connect with everything. That's the, in my opinion, that's my experience from grad school. Like, yeah, you know, do this whole social justice stuff. But really, like you were saying, and we keep continuing to talk about, like, I know, I ain't gonna name no names, but I know of people that I went to school with, and like, you hear about this modality and that modality. They're trying to go straight to the bag, and they're trying to just be this like next Brene Brown person on the TED Talks and stuff. And it's like, I felt at the time I felt conflicted because I'm like, well, damn, should I know that? Is that how to go? Until I met my brothers here, and it's like, that part's cool, but you got to do the social justice too. You can't have one without the other. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, one of the privileges of going to school in Hawaii was it was all about like Native Hawaiian culture, learning mm-hmm. about it and like honoring the land that you're on, that you're in, and not just honoring, but like taking care of it and the people. In Hawaii, you know, community, family, and land came first, and then work came second. So I remember My first year in graduate school, I was pregnant with my middle child, and I forgot to do a paper. And I was talk about an anxiety attack. I came from USC, super competitive there. I thought I was gonna fail the class. And my professor's like, oh, it's okay, just get it to me next week. I'm like, you mean like I don't gotta get it to you like tonight? And they're like, no, get it to me next week. They're like, take care of yourself. And I was like, dang. So going to school in Hawaii really pushed social justice and the issues that the native Hawaiian people were experiencing and continue to experience today.
Mm. For sure. Yeah, I mean, that's that piece that like we've all accepted being a part of this field, like the internalized capitalism and white supremacy. And so how much of our worth is tied to productivity, and it's all about deadlines and like mm-hmm. just that shit where it's just like, nah, there's stuff that's more important than that. You know what I mean?
What base were you at in Hawaii?
So my husband was stationed in Pearl Harbor, but we mm-hmm. didn't live on the base. We lived outside of the base. So, but yeah, we were joint base Pearl Harbor, Hickam. But I worked for Schofield, which is the army base on the opposite side of the island. But yeah, Hawaii is different. Mm-hmm. Like, I was surprised that my husband and I were both like accepted just based off of what we look like there. Like, it wasn't it's not like they would like reach out and say hi to us just because
family. Yeah.
Right. And, well, but also because. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, how do I say this? The fact that we are people of color, we're not Native Hawaiian.
Right.
My husband's black, I'm Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
like it was, I don't know. It felt like it was just kind of this understanding of like, mm-hmm. okay, you cool.
Yeah. We had the shared experience of colonization and imperialism. It's like, as long as you're not a Howley, like mm-hmm. we good.
I asked that question because in 2009, I worked at Pearl Harbor for like 5 weeks with like Navy dependent children and stuff. And I was directly across from the Aloha Bowl. Mm-hmm. And like, we went to like with the Pearl Ridge Mall. We'd be on Kamehameha Highway. We go up to like the North Shore. The North Shore is actually nice, but Brigham Young took over that spot over there. But I mm-hmm. asked that because when I went there, like within my first week, you know, we worked under the guise of, you know, defense, military, mm-hmm. doing services like day camps and such. And one of the houses that we went to of like, I guess one of the Navy wives was a white woman. And she pointed out the black people and the people of color. And she's like, yeah, the locals were like, you, they don't like me. And we got shamed for being melanated. But it's like, we didn't colonize our brothers and sisters, these brothers and sisters, y'all did. So it's just funny how just like the white guilt and blame got flipped to shame us when there's nothing to be shamed about having some melanation, you know?
In Hawaii, you know, Howleys, they get a little taste of what it's like to not be accepted, mm-hmm. you know? And that's I've never experienced that in my life until I went to Hawaii. It's like we would go to Nanakuli, which in Hawaii is like a rougher part of the island. And we would just, that was what you did. You went to the beach and the locals would be barbecuing and they see my husband, they'd be like, hey, come eat with us. Like, let's play some horseshoes. Mm-hmm. You know, so. It was just like this shared understanding of like, you're cool. Yeah. But military culture is interesting because it's like, you could be an officer's wife and like, they get the whole house. Like they don't get like the condos. Whereas like, if you're enlisted, like we were, you get the condos and you live like right across the street from each other. So it's just like this weird, like unsaid, unspoken type of hierarchy of power. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really like, I was just like, I don't understand this. Like I don't get it. So it's completely different, but we had two close families that we just kicked it with, went to the beach with, barbecued, and that's what made it unforgettable. I miss being over there.
Yeah. Yo, so I just have one more question. You know, once COVID is done, and the world is safe again, we about to get this Melanated Social Work US. No, it's going to be a world tour. So we're doing the world tour. So, you know, when we stop off in San Diego, what are the things to do? Like, what do you recommend? Like, where should we tap in San Diego?
So I would definitely recommend, I think San Diego has some of the best coffee shops. So I would say coffee shops. I would say go to the mom and pop taco spots too, if you like Mexican food. Also hiking. My husband's big on cycling, and so when you cycle, you go through all these different routes. So he's found like all these really dope hiking spots and parks. Grand View Beach is really nice, and I like Coronado Beach as well, but that's just because it's close to us.
I was just going to ask you if you like, that was my favorite beach. I heard they put gold flakes in the sand, so it's perfect because San Diego, Coronado. But yeah, beautiful beach.
Yeah, Coronado is our like family beach. That's where we go to. And yeah.
So cool. You don't want to freestyle right now, do you?
I mean, I definitely can't even think of spitting a freestyle right now. I could spit a written, but it's up to
you. So this, the diss track you was talking about.
Okay. If you want, If you would bless us, then Brittany.
I'm down for written. I'm down for whatever you have. Whatever. I'm just a fan of live music. We haven't been able to see it in a long time now.
That part.
Well, I have to tell you, it's a little aggressive. So I'm not. It's more so like a verse that I wrote about kind of coming into my own healing and freedom as a social worker and having liberation over my work and autonomy over my work. So, mm-hmm. And it's critical of the traditional mental health model. So
we down with the smoke. We ready.
All right. Hey, yo, I'm tired of being oppressed by you. You say you client-centered, but nowhere in there do I see the benefits of my people. See, I'm the people's therapist. It's people over profit, people over nonsense, people over what's common. And I've been damn near exhausted playing the game. Smile on my face, leading out of fear and shame. Agency games, 2020, yeah, a pain. But I know I ain't the same. You better put some respect on my name because I ain't playing. I promise you, you need me more than I need you. It took me a minute to understand that. But now that I do, I'm invincible, recommitted to my values and principles. The fact that we made it this far was damn near a miracle. Your broken systems got me hella cynical. Traditional, antiquated model, this gets political, spiritual, so much more than what is clinical. Because to me, your best practices is straight pitiful. But I'm just one that got free, scot-free, DSM, ICD, you can't see me. Like Pac said, we are the roads that will rise above the concrete. Try to silence me all day, but here's my critique. Chill out on the ego, be about the people, know that we will rise. We are so sick of the sequels. And if you're uncomfortable, I'm not sorry. In fact, I say job well done, throw your pity party. I never expected you to get it. But know this, I will no longer be limited by your limits. Moving forward, now we are finished. Like you used to tell me, you've used my billable minutes.
Hey!
That's it, y'all. Mic drop.
I need your honest feedback, though. Is that too aggressive to release?
No.
Hell no. Hell no. Hell no.
Here you go.
Not at all.
Absolutely release it. Please. Yeah.
And you're making history because you're the first person ever on our podcast to hit those bars, hit the lyrics, and give us a little. Yeah. How many bars is that? Like 40 bars?
I don't know. I wrote it to... So do you remember that J. Cole performance he did where it's just the instrumental and mm-hmm. I think it was a night show or Jimmy Kimmel.
Mm-hmm.
It's written to a track like that where there's really no beat. It's just like a bass line and a like piano. So there's it's not like it's really more so. I'm probably going to put it out to be like a spoken word slash rap like he did it because it's important. If I don't know if people will understand it if they're not in a social worker or in the mental health field, but
yes, drop that shit.
Yes, yes, please. Absolutely. You heard it right here first, y'all.
Yo, Brittany, we appreciate you rocking with us today. Could you tell the folks if they want to tap in with you or just stay plugged in to the things you're doing, how can they follow you or follow your work?
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram and TikTok, and you can follow me at BWilliamsLCSW. Also, my private practice is called Courage Over Comfort Counseling. And so me and my business partner, Carlos, we go live on TikTok every Sunday, and we're going to start doing it on Instagram. But, you know, I'm also doing hip hop therapy weekly clubhouse groups where we're going to be looking at therapeutic themes and songs. We're actually going to be doing that on Instagram, too. And so, yeah.
All right, y'all.
Yes.
So y'all know what you need to do. Stay tapped in. Follow Brittany on all the things. Tap in on TikTok, on Clubhouse. But yeah, that's it. Yep. All right, y'all.
Appreciate you.
All right. Thank you.